The connection in New Orleans is all around you, right? It's in the music, it's in the food, it's in the culture with the carnival, when people get married, when people are put to rest, when they die. So in New Orleans celebrating its tricentennial, I think it's only natural that Haiti play its proper role in that celebration. There's no denying it. I mean, you know, we're kin. Could try to deny it, but, you know, history would prove you otherwise.
This is Tripod, New Orleans at 300. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levenson, and today we bring you an hour-long special that explores the relationship between the two places that guy was just talking about, Haiti and New Orleans. As our regular listeners know, this whole podcast is leading up to the tricentennial of New Orleans. 300 years, and definitely no shortage of material. But throughout the past two seasons of Tripod, one place kept coming up: Haiti, and the Haitian Revolution, which remains the only successful slave rebellion in the Americas. That revolution lasted from 1791 until 1804 and led to a mass migration from Haiti to New Orleans that shaped the city's culture so intensely, a lot of people here in New Orleans still talk about that Haitian influence. A lot. Haiti remains an important part of the story New Orleans tells about itself. But on the flip side, is New Orleans part of the Haiti story? All of this made me wonder, hey, Haiti, is the feeling mutual? Stay tuned. You're listening to the Tripod special, Haiti and New Orleans, is the feeling mutual? I'm Lane Kaplan-Levenson. Barbara Trevine is dressed in all white, from head wrap to sandals. Her immaculate outfit does not stop her from lying face down on the ground of the St. Jude Shrine at the edge of the French Quarter. Surrounding candles bathe her in light as she whispers her prayers into the floor. This is how I found Barbara when I arrived at the church to meet her, praying. As a ritual, she always wears all white when she prays, and she loves to pray here.
Because of the candles, because of the saints that's up there, it feels right.
She has Haitian roots, and she wanted to meet me at this church because it's one of the spots in New Orleans where Barbara feels most connected to Haiti.
Tell me specifically about the Haitian side of your family.
Mine escaped from St. Mark, and some went to Jamaica, and some went to Cuba. And then they came to New Orleans.
What does it mean for you to have that connection and that tie?
It helps me who I am and what I do.
There are a lot of people like Barbara in New Orleans whose ancestors come from Haiti. But not everyone's as into genealogical research like Barbara. So I asked her,
do you think that people in New Orleans generally know about this historical connection?
Yes. A lot has been written about it. I have written a lot about it. People do talk about it. So we keep perpetuating and saying it over and over and over to get the word out that, you know, you are more Haitian here than anything because of the influx of Haitians that gave New Orleans its flavor and its culture. You know, so we're more Haitian than anything.
By we, Barbara means native New Orleanians. And then, as if it were a setup, Barbara turns to a woman sitting a few pews behind us and ropes her into the conversation.
You have ancestors from Haiti?
No, I don't, but I have friends who do. You know the Burns and the Dumases?
Yeah.
All of their family originates.
Same tribe.
Yeah.
Barbara's relatives leaving Haiti and making their way to New Orleans is part of a larger migration of people fleeing Haiti during its revolution at the turn of the 19th century. The Haitian Revolution is the only successful rebellion by enslaved people in the Americas. And when it ended and Haiti became independent, thousands of white, free black, and enslaved people fled or were forced from the island. Most went to New Orleans and Cuba. Then, a few years later, those same Haitian refugees that went to Cuba were expelled from Cuba. We'll get deeper into all this in a bit. So they also came to New Orleans. This was 1809, when 10,000 Haitians arrived and doubled the population of the city. Doubled. This is partly why so many New Orleans families today are people of Haitian descent, and why a Creole culture born from African and European ancestry defined both places and bind them together. There are these similarities in heritage and homelands, and there's also the architecture, religion, music, dance, food, carnival, and vulnerability to natural disaster. For all these reasons, Barbara believes Haiti is part of her city's identity, and says other New Orleanians do too. I'm not a native New Orleanian, but a lot of locals associate this connection with who they are as people, even all these generations later. There's this saying that New Orleans is the northernmost point of the Caribbean. That basically comes from the city's relationship with Haiti, and is one reason why New Orleans fancies itself part of the Caribbean, and Haiti in particular, something of a sister city. But is New Orleans just fancying itself? Do Haitians think of New Orleans this way? Do they think of New Orleans at all? These two places were tied at the hip 200 years ago, but where does their relationship stand today? Let's find out. You are listening to the Tripod special, Haiti and New Orleans is the Feeling Mutual. This story is told in three parts. The history of the original connection between these two places, what happened over time, and what the future can hold. Part one, the one-way trip.
Shanté. I don't hear the music.
This is André Pult belting his brains out behind the wheel of his forest green 4Runner as it shakily bumps down a dirt road. André's what's called a fixer. He works with reporters when they travel to Haiti, and this is our sixth day together.
Femme ça mauvais, mauvais olé.
We're driving to a city called Jacmel, about 3 hours south of Port-au-Prince. André's Trey excited about this trip.
Welcome to Jacmel!
Jacmel is right on the coast and feels like a beach town surrounded by lush green mountains. It's gorgeous. It gets more tourists than Port-au-Prince these days, not only because there are beautiful beaches, but because Jacmel is known for its carnival celebration. The city is famous for its papier-mâché carnival masks that people collect year-round. And no matter when you visit, you'll find artists painting them as you walk through the streets. We arrive at our first stop and meet our tour guide for the day, Jean-Élie Gill.
Bonjour.
Everyone says hello, and Jean-Élie introduces himself.
I was born and raised in Jacmel, and I wrote books, lots of books about Jacmel. So that's mostly what I'm doing, writing. Living, enjoying life.
So please show us the best of the city.
He leads us towards the Florida Hotel, where we get right down to business. Maybe because he knows we're coming from New Orleans, I don't know, but Jean-Élie orders a round of drinks.
The best warm sour is here in Jacmel, in Florida Hotel. It's the best warm sour in Haiti. Because this guy has a secret of doing something, I don't know what, but it is good.
That rum sour was really good, but it wasn't the only reason Jean-Élie brought us to the Florida Hotel. First of all, it's beautiful. The exterior is painted a cream-colored brick, and the doors are this sky blue. Slim columns support an iron-laced balcony off the second floor that has these huge ferns in planters with water dripping from the bottom down to the curb. Everything about it looks exactly like what you would find in the French Quarter.
Same kind of architecture and design.
It's not just the Florida Hotel. Most of Jacmel is built in the same colonial style we see in the French Quarter, the Tremé, the Marigny, and all over New Orleans. Two-story buildings with wrought iron railings stuffed with hanging ferns, bright-colored shotgun houses, Creole cottages. It was like a spitting image. To literally see the connection through this architecture was almost dizzying.
This stretch right here really looks like New Orleans with these doors.
Is it what remains from that connection between Jacmel and New Orleans and Louisiana?
That's André again, my fixer, saying this is what remains of that connection. which makes it seem like something happened to this connection, something's changed. But when did this connection start in the first place? I asked almost every Haitian I met, where does this shared history begin?
It starts with our revolution.
Haitian Revolution.
The Haitian Revolution.
After the initial revolution here.
And the incidents that had on New Orleans.
The Louisiana Purchase.
So the Louisiana Purchase happened.
Napoleon selling New Orleans. That has to do with the Haitian Revolution. So
Haiti played a huge part in the fact that Napoleon sold Louisiana territories to the United States.
The Haitian Revolution is what it helped cause that sale.
Big time. Even though it wasn't its purpose.
Looks like we should start with the Haitian Revolution. You'll meet all the people you just heard from, but let's start with the last voice you heard, Henri Jolibois.
Henri Jolibois, I'm saying it in French, which is the proper way.
Henri's an architect and historian who lives in Pétionville, a wealthy suburb about 20 minutes or 2 hours south of Port-au-Prince, depending on the traffic. Most people who can afford it choose to live in Pétionville over Port-au-Prince. Unlike most towns in Haiti, Pétionville's got sushi restaurants, yoga studios, iced coffee, and has its own private trash pickup service. It's a stark contrast from Port-au-Prince, where poorer residents often get rid of their trash by burning it on the side of the road. There are a few nice areas of Port-au-Prince, though. I stayed in one, in a neighborhood called Paco. Still, this type of disparity is not new to the island. Back to Henri.
Well, everybody wanted freedom.
Everybody wanted their freedom. Before Haiti was Haiti, it was a French colony called Saint-Domingue. Sugar and coffee ruled and made the colony wealthy on the backs of thousands of enslaved Africans. By the 1760s, Saint-Domingue was the most profitable colony in the Americas. This prosperity came at the expense of brutal, often fatal labor in the fields. So large numbers of enslaved people fled the plantations for the mountains, where they established maroon colonies and started planning a revolution.
The revolution was started with the French Revolution.
Henri says when the French Revolution began in 1789, there was lots of division, to put it mildly. Some whites in Saint-Domingue opposed the revolution in France, while others supported it in hopes of gaining the colony's independence. The free people of color, or gens de couleur, pressed for the equal rights that French Revolution seemed to promise. Then there were the enslaved and maroon populations, which, by the way, outnumbered whites on the island 10 to 1. They saw this political crisis as an opportunity to strike for their freedom, which led to
the Boukman Experience, the big slave revolt of the North.
The Boukman Experience is what's widely considered the start of the Haitian Revolution. This happened in 1791, when a voodoo priest named Dudi Boukman led a religious ceremony to kick off the first successful slave rebellion in the northern part of the colony.
The revolutionaries, their idea was simple. At the end of it all, we will be able to negotiate better agreements and freedom for all. When finally we stopped fighting, the Haitians had won, and they had created one nation.
It was 1804. The enslaved population liberated itself, and their victory remains the largest and most successful slave uprising in the Americas. This uprising shed the colonial name Saint-Domingue, and the new black nation was called Haiti. The name Haiti comes from the indigenous language of the Taino people, who were native to the island. It means land of high mountains. So they ditched the French name, and all the French are like, we should probably go.
They went to Louisiana because it was another colony of France. It was part of the French network.
Now, people had been fleeing Haiti over the course of this 13-year revolution to go live in other French colonies. Some went to Caribbean islands like Guadeloupe and Martinique, a lot went to Cuba, and many went to Louisiana. And it wasn't just white people who fled. A lot of enslaved and free people of color went with white Haitians to New Orleans, either with their master or to escape all the violence and turmoil that was happening on the island. When the revolution finally ends, Napoleon is like, okay, I am spread too thin. Forget about Haiti. I need to double down on Europe.
Well, better try to get Europe and forget about the Americas. So the Louisiana Purchase happened.
When you put the last battle of the Haitian Revolution and the signing of the Louisiana Purchase on a timeline, They happened just months apart in 1803. Now, fast forward to 1809. Spain's at war with France, and all that bad blood seeps into the Caribbean. Cuba is a Spanish colony, but it's full of all these French emigres that left Haiti during the revolution. So during this war, Spain ups and kicks out all the French, which means that all those people who had fled to Cuba from Haiti need to leave again. Where do they know a guy? Louisiana.
A part of our society just went to reproduce itself there, like a chemical process.
This is Jean-Marie Théoda, a geographer who lives in a town also called Théoda. We met him in his backyard, where he's got tons of animals. Three dogs, cages full of cooing doves, and roosters.
A lot of slaves, a lot of masters escaped from Saint-Domingue, went to Louisiana and created a Creole culture.
Almost overnight, 10,000 people of Haitian descent, a third white, a third enslaved, and a third free people of color, arrived at the port of New Orleans and straight up doubled the size of the city.
I mean, when I listen to your music and sometimes taste to your cook, I said, this is ours.
This is how Jean-Marie sees it. The Saint-Domingue colony didn't disappear. Parts of it just kind of picked up and started over again somewhere else, which had a big impact on both economies. The Haitian Revolution devastated Haiti's economy, leaving the new nation with almost nothing but burnt sugarcane fields. But when all those refugees, many of them planters, came to Louisiana, they started new plantations along the Mississippi River. The sugar industry exploded and brought a lot of wealth to Louisiana and New Orleans. This influx of Haitian refugees also came at an oddly convenient time to reshape the city. Even though New Orleans had been around for almost a century when they arrived, in a lot of ways, the city was almost a blank slate at that moment. The refugees pull up to this little frontier town that's recovering from two massive fires that almost entirely wiped out New Orleans in the late 1700s. New Orleans was rebuilding itself, and at the same time had just become an American city. It was a prime time for all these Haitians to come and develop this old and new town. This is the root of the connection between Haiti and New Orleans. These major migrations transformed the future of the city during such a pivotal time, influencing its culture in every aspect: food, music, art, dance, language. But with all that was brought to New Orleans, was there a reciprocal influence happening back in the new country of Haiti? Again, Jean-Marie Théoda.
I personally, as a geographer, I know about it, but still, I think the very average of Haitian don't know about that.
For him, it's simple.
I look to Louisiana, it's like another island. Far away, it was a one-way trip.
Two islands, far away, coming up. You are listening to the Tripod Special, Haiti and New Orleans. Is the feeling mutual? Stay with us. We have reached part two of our story. Part two, Two Islands.
Okay, what are the questions that we want to ask?
Because I live in New Orleans, Louisiana. We're trying to talk to as many people in Port-au-Prince as we can to find out what they know about New Orleans.
Okay.
I'm with my field producer, Wynne Muscatine Graham. We're walking around one of the main public squares in Port-au-Prince called the Champ de Mars. It's a series of public parks that are separated by large boulevards congested with cars, motorbikes, and colorfully painted public transportation buses called tap-taps. It's late afternoon, and street vendors push carts offering freshly chopped coconut, candy, beer, ice cream, and others ring bells as they call up the service they're offering, like a shoe shine or a small bag of drinking water. People walk through the park and pass us in business attire on their way home from work. Others sprawl out under a shady tree and watch a pickup game of soccer on an open patch of dirt. Wynne and I wonder how many of these people know about the connection between New Orleans and Haiti. I mean, how many people walking past us in the heart of Port-au-Prince have ever heard of New Orleans, period? And say, so I just want to ask first, have you heard of it?
I'm very nervous.
She may be nervous, but she's the one that speaks Creole, so...
Bonsoir. Alors, n'absorti en zone qui est Nouvelle-Orléans. Or New Orleans.
Wynn explains that we're from a city called New Orleans in the United States, and we want to know if people in Haiti have heard of this city.
New Orleans.
New York?
No, pas New York. New Orleans.
New York, the man asks? No, New Orleans, Wynn answers.
Mandadil.
No, I haven't heard of it, he says.
Okay. Merci.
We did this in a few different cities in Haiti. Port-au-Prince and Jacmel in the south, and up north in cities like Gonaïves, Cap-Haïtien, and villages in between. Everywhere we went, we got mostly the same response.
No,
no, no,
no,
no, no, no,
no,
no, no, no, no, no, no, no,
okay, merci en pile.
The average person on the street had never heard of New Orleans, with a few exceptions. Some high school students we met had heard of Hurricane Katrina through hearing it on the news.
Katrina, vraiment, on compte ça à la radio.
And others knew that New Orleans celebrates carnival, just like they do in Haiti.
Pour carnaval, New Orleans fait carnaval comme un business.
And then we met a guy named Gregory who knows New Orleans because he's an NBA fan. There's a good basketball team from there, he says. I think he might be talking about the Pelicans, but I'm really not sure. So then Wynn asks him if he knows any people who live in Louisiana.
Well, I've heard Haitians live there, but me personally, I don't have family living in Louisiana. My family lives in Florida or New York City, if they live in the U.S.
Florida and New York. That's where you'll find much of the Haitian diaspora today, Gregory tells us. So if thousands of Haitians moved to New Orleans 200 years ago, why'd they stop coming? What happened?
Louisiana has largely forgotten Haiti, and Haiti has largely forgotten that Louisiana exists.
This is Georges Michel.
Louisiana has sunk into oblivion.
Georges Michel is super knowledgeable and super dramatic. He's a historian and asked me to meet him at the famous Hotel Olufsen in Port-au-Prince. He visits the hotel almost every night to eat dinner on the veranda and swears by the food, but he's a little picky.
I'm not a chicken person. I'm not a poultry person.
He does love the fried pork, though, which he washes down with Haiti's national beer called Prestige. And he loves history. He initiated our meal by announcing...
I know the list of all U.S. presidents by heart.
All right, go.
George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison.
Fast forwarding here.
George Bush Jr., Barack Obama, Donald J. Trump.
No!
Georges Michel knows so much about the U.S. and U.S. history and could have gone all night listing facts and lecturing on literally anything, which was tempting, honestly. But to stay on topic, Georges listed links that once existed between New Orleans and Haiti, links that are now gone.
When I was a boy...
So like the 50s, 60s.
You had a thrice a week a direct flight by Delta Airlines from Port-au-Prince to New Orleans. No more. We did maintain a consulate in New Orleans. I think that it is gone.
It is.
We used to have shipping lines between New Orleans and the Haitian ports. This is long gone as New Orleans dropped as an important port in the United States.
New Orleans still has an active port, but it's not what it used to be. The port employs a lot fewer people. Haitians looking for a better life in the U.S. can find more prospects in other cities, like Miami, the city with the highest Haitian population, by a lot, followed by New York and then Boston. There is still an active Haitian community here, but it's also not what it used to be. New Orleans doesn't even crack the top 10 for Haitian populations in the U.S. So to explain why Haitians stopped coming to New Orleans, we arrive at factor number one, jobs.
New Orleans is not the most prosperous place.
Oof, true. This is Vladimir Laborde, a Haitian businessman who lives and works in Port-au-Prince. He says when you think of the U.S.
You don't think of New Orleans. And then the proximity as far as logistics, people go to Miami. Miami's less than an hour in the air.
It's an issue of geography.
Factor number two, geography. That's Michel Pierre-Louis, a former prime minister of Haiti who now teaches the history of the Caribbean at a university in Port-au-Prince.
Getting into the Gulf was too difficult. you know, whereas the tides take you to Miami.
Plus, Miami's population exploded in the 20th century. In 1910, Miami was brand spanking new. Only 5,000 people lived there. 10 years later, there were 30,000. And people just kept on coming. As Miami grew, so did the economy. So why go to New Orleans when you can get to a faster growing city even faster?
So they go to Miami because, as you're explaining it, that you can basically, you know, blow the boat over there. And from there, they find out about bigger cities in the U.S. that have opportunity, even though they might realize if they went to New Orleans that they would feel more at home there.
Maybe, but I don't think it was in their mindset. They didn't travel with an idea that that particular state had a connection with Haiti.
How come?
History is not well taught at all in Haiti.
Factor number three to explain why Haitians stopped coming to New Orleans? Education.
I'm telling you, I'm teaching at the university and I can see the ignorance of our students. With so little knowledge of our own history, which is so incredible.
And why is that?
The dictatorship killed a lot of things here. There was a big darkness in a way.
The Duvalier dictatorship started when Haiti elected François Duvalier, aka Papa Doc, on a populist platform in 1957. He ruled the country with his own militia called the Tonton Macou. When he died in 1971, his son, Jean-Claude, aka Baby Doc, took over.
Duvalier had changed the curriculum of teaching history at the primary and secondary level. Our heroes was the most important.
Her point here is that Haitians are mostly unaware of the connection that they have to New Orleans because that's just one of many gaps in their history curriculum. But it goes both ways. There's a parallel gap going on here with the U.S. I mean, I didn't learn about the Haitian Revolution in high school. Did you? There's a big silence on this end. Dennis Kelly has been doing business with Haiti for the past 30 years and splits his time between New Orleans and Port-au-Prince.
Many Haitians or people of Haitian heritage who live here have never been to Haiti.
So New Orleanians talk about Haiti, but they don't actually go to Haiti. Factor number four, not going to Haiti, which explains why the two islands are no longer close. And we're referring to them as two islands, but it's important to remember that one is a small country, one of the poorest in the world, and the other a small city that's part of the wealthiest country in the world. So these quote-unquote two islands are no longer close. Vladimir Laborde, the Haitian businessman you heard from earlier, who, by the way, moved to New Orleans from Haiti with his family when he was a kid and went to high school here, he has a phrase for this kind of, I don't know, unconsummated love.
Affinity diaspora?
Affinity diaspora. It means that New Orleanians...
they don't know how they're related to Haitians. They really can't put their finger on it. They just feel a connection. Sometimes I'm uncomfortable because they haven't been here yet and they're talking about something they may not know.
I brought this up with a professor at Loyola University in New Orleans named Angel Parham. I told her what Vlad said about the connection New Orleanians feel.
They know it's there, they feel it, they talk about it, but they don't actually know much beyond that.
They don't.
Angel wrote a book called American Roots that traces the experience of Haitian descendants in Louisiana. She interviewed a lot of folks in New Orleans for the book.
How many of the people that you interviewed have visited Haiti?
I don't think any of them had visited Haiti. I do not recall anyone making a real trip to Haiti. Mm-mm. No.
This reminds me of Barbara Trevine. Remember the woman in the beginning wearing all white and praying at the St. Jude Shrine? We met at that shrine because it's a place in New Orleans that reminds Barbara of Haiti. So that day, I asked her...
And have you been to Haiti?
No. I know with all of this. I know.
And I know she wants to, but she hasn't made Haiti happen yet. Loyola Haitian scholar Angel Parham.
People may be interested in talking about it, but how interested are they in actually traveling to Haiti? Are they going to feel that it's a place that they will be safe and so on? You know, so Haiti does not have this image like much of the Caribbean as, you know, a tourist destination that everyone wants to go to.
a lot of the people Angel interviewed feel this nostalgic affinity towards the Haiti they have in their minds, but it's almost like they want to keep it that way.
It's one thing to kind of claim this Caribbean heritage and memory, but then to not be supportive of it, I think, is problematic.
Some of this could be financial. As Vlad Laborde said, New Orleans is not the most prosperous place. There may be plenty of folks who would love to travel to Haiti, but simply can't afford it. That's real. But there are other reasons why New Orleanians and others don't visit. Think about this for a second. What comes into your mind when you hear the word Haiti?
Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, has been hit by a major earthquake.
An American hospital volunteer is being held tonight in one of Haiti's worst prisons, accused of kidnapping a 15-month-old, deathly ill child after turning the boy into a zombie. That's right, a zombie.
Looters were running rampant in Port-au-Prince Thursday as earthquake survivors have become even more desperate for food, water, and any kind of aid.
Meanwhile, in Haiti, the earthquake back in January has led to a deadly epidemic of cholera. And today,
with the smell of death and the stink of smoke, downtown Port-au-Prince now feels like a war zone. Gangs with machetes.
Doesn't exactly make you want to catch the next flight over there, does it?
We have bad press.
Vladimir Laborde.
The perception is this is no man's land. People think of Haiti and they say, dude, I need security, my insurance won't let me go down there.
And this negative image of Haiti has been broadcast to the world since day one.
We paid a dear price for that revolution.
It all goes back to the Haitian Revolution. It's like what brought New Orleans and Haiti together is the exact same thing that was used to keep them apart. In essence,
for doing away with the slave system.
We were punished many times and many times over for daring to free ourselves. And we have been paying for it a long time.
There was French diplomatic, very, very intense efforts to tell the Americans, don't have a relationship with Haiti because it's going to cost you.
And we're isolated because of that.
They could not accept that a group of black people could win a battle against France and establish their own country and have it work, because that would destroy the whole ideology of racism.
That last voice you heard is Ron Blunschley, an American who lives with his wife, Carla, in the mountains outside Port-au-Prince. They run an organization called Nasanje, which in Creole means "we will remember."
Europe, France, and the United States were determined to see Haiti fail from the very start. So they set the course in motion to destroy this country, and they never let up.
In the 1820s, South Carolina Senator Robert V. Hayne made the U.S. position absolutely clear when he stated, "Our policy with regard to Haiti is plain. We never can acknowledge her independence." It took the United States until 1862 to recognize Haiti as an independent country, almost 60 years after the revolution. Now, fast forward to 1893, the Chicago World Fair. Frederick Douglass is the U.S. ambassador to Haiti. And in a speech at that World Fair, Douglass says, "Haiti is black, and we have not yet forgiven Haiti for being black." Dennis Kelly is the businessman who lives in New Orleans and Port-au-Prince. He says the revolution remained unthinkable into the 20th century because it overturned white power.
Haiti was still viewed as a slave colony that was insurrectionist and just didn't affirm many values of the power elite in the South, shall we say. And let's just, I think that sums it up right there.
You're saying that that can likely be traced back to the events of the beginning of the 19th century, of the successful revolution.
Absolutely, yeah, that's directly traced to that.
Haiti's been painted as a dangerous place since the beginning, and people are still not encouraged to visit there. The poverty, the threat of natural disaster, the political instability, all of this dominates what we hear on the news about Haiti and has done permanent damage to the country's reputation, economy, and tourism industry. Americans are not eager to go over there. So while many New Orleanians may appreciate all the cultural ties they share with Haiti, the music, the food, the architecture, they've never actually seen it for themselves. This is the complicated nature of the current relationship. New Orleans might love Haiti, but at arm's length.
Here we go. Okay.
My fixer, Andre, is taking my producer, Wynn, and I to go see his cousin, Lionel Pressoir. He's a tour guide outside Port-au-Prince. Andre and Lionel have a few cousins, by the way.
We have over 300 cousins.
Do you know all of the cousins?
Of course not!
But Lionel has known Andre since he was a baby, and they're really close. Some of their ancestors actually left Haiti for New Orleans during the Revolution. But now, he says, they've gone in different directions.
There's not the contact that I thought there was between Haiti and New Orleans. But we're looking for it. We need it.
So how does it make you feel to know that there are so many people in New Orleans that do claim that sister city?
Oh, I would love it. Let's act on it. That's the priority. You know, we can talk about it, but let's see what we can do as far as bringing something positive.
So it's not enough just to say we are sister cities?
No way. No way.
Lionel's being polite, but I'm pretty sure what he's saying translates to put your money where your mouth is. More on that coming up. You are listening to the Tripod Special, Haiti and New Orleans. Is the feeling mutual? We'll be right back. We have arrived at part three of our special, part three, More Than a Feeling.
Particularly, I remember Layla, my daughter, called me and she said, Mom, you need to move to New Orleans. It's so much like Haiti. You're going to love it. There's corruption. There's potholes. It's just an incredible place.
This is Gigi.
Of course, that's not what I love about Haiti, but...
Gigi was born in Haiti, but her family moved to the States when she was a kid. Now her kids are all grown up, and they live in New Orleans. They urged her to move here, said she would feel at home. So she did.
My last name is Dupuis. People assume I'm from New Orleans, but it took me a while to realize that until I went to yoga class. The woman registering participants said to me, what's your first name? And I said, well, I'm sure there's only one Dupuis because there never was more than one Dupuis. And she said, no, actually, I have six. And I was like, what?
You know, you go into the phone book in New Orleans and it's like you look in the phone book of Haiti.
That's Vladimir Laborde again, the Haitian businessman who went to high school in New Orleans and then moved back to Haiti.
You find Labordes, you find Toussaint's, you find Barons, you know. So all those people have my family's last name. So
yeah, I know some Labordes in New Orleans.
My long-lost cousins.
When Gigi goes back to Haiti to visit her cousins, she talks about New Orleans.
What do you say to people when they ask you how it is there?
I say it's very similar. The most similar.
We've been talking about this historical connection between New Orleans and Haiti for a while now. But I just want to take a second to say that no matter what's happened to this relationship over time, no matter who was supposed to call who back and all that, New Orleans and Haiti still have so much in common. It's crazy. And it's more than names and colonial buildings. When I was there, I saw snowballs, the New Orleans version of shaved ice. I ordered to-go drinks. I weaved around huge potholes. I heard a brass band tuning up for a jazz funeral. I saw people cooking with Merloton. I saw a voodoo ceremony. I read the names of businesses spelled out on hand-painted signs. I could go on. We're a lot alike. The good, the bad, and the disastrous.
Not only do we have a historical and cultural ties, but we have a traumatic experience that almost wiped us out.
New Orleans has Hurricane Katrina, which ravaged the city in 2005, and Haiti has its earthquake that hit in 2010. The quake devastated most of the country, leveling cities and destroying major landmarks that, as of 2017, are still piles of rubble. The degree of blight reminded me of some of the largest buildings in New Orleans that have been left virtually untouched since Katrina, like Charity Hospital in the center of downtown. And, like in New Orleans, the aftermath of disaster isn't just seen, it's heard.
I was standing up when the house went down.
Remember Jean-Elie Gilles, the guy who wants all the rum sours? The day that we spent together, he gave us a long tour of his house. He started talking to us about a coffee table in his living room.
I have one of his table there.
There must have been something about that table, because before we knew it, Jean-Elie was back in 2010.
I was living on the sixth floor, and then the house went down like that. But I was inside.
You were on the sixth floor when the house went down?
Yeah.
And yes. You went down to the ground?
Yes. I was all the way living in upstairs, and then I fell like that. And then the house that was beside me, that was taller, the house just went down like that. It was like a pile of cards, you know, like nothing. And the people were...
He went on with no idea how long ago he had stopped at the top of his staircase, looking beyond all of us, past the house we were all standing in, at the house he lost.
I'm swearing that I could hear the sound of the earth crying. It's worse than anything that you have ever heard. It's like the sound of 10,000 women screaming from the womb. It's scary. I heard it, and I was not the only one. Very painful. Oh. Okay, let's go.
This kind of time travel, this relived trauma, still happens in New Orleans, too.
New Orleans went through Katrina. So they know a lot about disaster.
And they know what it's like to see a city full of holes. When our driver, Andre, gave us a tour of Port-au-Prince, most of what he stopped to show us were things that used to be there, things that aren't there anymore.
On the left, we had the National Palace collapse after the quake.
And that's why, after the quake, we felt like we were lost. Because all the landmarks that we could use to indicate a place, most of them were gone. Same as after Katrina, I guess.
After the earthquake slammed Haiti in 2010, and again after Hurricane Matthew in 2014, people around the world ask themselves what their obligations are to this country, a country that throughout history has been cast aside and treated as other. Well, Vlad Laborde says New Orleans knows what that's like too.
New Orleans, Louisiana, oftentimes feels apart from the rest of the United States. Haiti oftentimes feels itself apart from the rest of the Caribbean.
After Katrina, people threw around the idea of not rebuilding the city, period. Like New Orleans was an expendable part of the U.S., or not part of it at all. The same way Haiti has been punished for its blackness, many say New Orleans was shunned for that same reason. Still, thousands of people did rush in to try to help. Haiti and New Orleans have both been on the receiving end of countless recovery projects and NGO missions. And both places have felt exploited, seeing too many of these fail over and over again. This shared experience and the mutual understanding it creates might put Haiti and New Orleans in a position to work together. There's a fear in Haiti that things are disappearing, literally. Much of Haiti's built environment is deteriorating, whether it's an earthquake that swiftly wipes huge landmarks off the map or the slow crumbling of a 300-year-old shotgun house. Because New Orleans shares this distinct architecture, it knows how to restore and preserve Haiti's historic buildings. John Williams runs Williams Architects in New Orleans.
You know how many projects I've done in the French Quarter?
How many?
Take a wild guess.
Let's see, 135.
Way over 500.
John's responsible for a lot of the restoration of the French Quarter and has done tons of work in the Lower Ninth Ward since Katrina.
I didn't ever intend to go to Haiti.
Nor did he want to. But after the earthquake, Vlad Laborde came a-knockin'.
Well, he brought me two bottles of Bovincourt.
Haitian rum.
So it was over then, you know, and I said, okay.
Since then, John's been to Haiti more than 10 times, visiting cities devastated by earthquakes and hurricanes.
I know little teeny hardware details and woodwork details that I saw in Cape Haitien that are exactly copied in the French Quarter.
Which means he knows how to repair those details and keep those buildings alive. This is crucial, says Pierre Chauvin. He's the former minister of tourism in Haiti and can recite by memory all the past tourism marketing slogans.
Haiti, it's like nowhere else. Haiti, a land of artists. Haiti, it's spellbinding. Haiti, part French, part African, part American, 100% Haitian.
It's no follow your NOLA, but it brings us to the next thing New Orleans knows a thing or two about, tourism. Pierre says architecture in New Orleans is a huge attraction for tourists. An artist named Paul Baruch knows this.
This is what I want Jacmel to look like. Nouvelle Orléans.
Paul runs one of the many carnival-themed art galleries in Jacmel. When I told Paul where I was visiting from, that's when she said she wished Jacmel looked like New Orleans. Or even more like it.
Because New Orleans looks like Jacmel. You know, but Jacmel is not well taken care of. And that will bring tourism, will bring a new life for the people here. Why don't you send us some tourism?
She laughed too, but she was serious. Like she was egging us on to share the wealth, which is an interesting thought. Just because New Orleans can do this stuff, does that mean it should? I brought up this question of responsibility to Dennis Kelly, the American businessman who works part-time in Haiti.
There's no way you can make New Orleans responsible for Haiti or Haiti responsible for New Orleans. But what you can do is say, what opportunities are there that I want to take advantage of? And so I would say that there are many opportunities to mutually benefit one another.
Vladimir Laborde is all about the mutual benefit and says an obvious opportunity here is Mardi Gras.
Imagine now the Miami Herald and the Times-Picayune and the New York Times and New Orleans and Jacmel, Haiti, share Carnival 2018.
He sees Mardi Gras as an overlapping tradition that could raise the big bucks to revitalize cities like Jacmel, and that those revenue streams will make communities more livable for Haitians and more hospitable for tourists. But these are tricky words in New Orleans. There's endless debate surrounding who's actually benefiting from preservation and tourism efforts. There's skepticism towards these projects. Are they actually improving the quality of life for the New Orleanian? Or the quality of experience for the visitor? These are some of the questions Haiti has to reckon with as it grows its tourism industry and preservation program. And both those things are important, not only for the economic boost, but that more existential fear of disappearing. Pierre Chauvin, the former minister of tourism, will never forget a conversation he once had with a European colleague.
He came to visit Haiti. He said, I've come to realize that in Haiti, you're full of diamonds. The whole country is full of diamonds. But you know, diamonds are stones. They have to be polished. Yet in Haiti, you don't polish them at all. And he was talking about these old houses, about, you know, our nature and everything else that we have. And certain things are really crumbling and you cannot recreate them.
Haiti's former Prime Minister Michel Pierre-Louis says it's not just about tourism dollars or physical structures. It's about Haiti reclaiming its image.
It's extremely important to make sure that little students, little pupils from kindergarten know about the country, that the country is not reductible to violence and misery and poverty, because we don't have just drug dealers and bad politicians. We have Haitians that are great, that are artists, that are creative, and that, you know, live with dignity.
This is the vision of Haiti that New Orleans chooses to see in itself, one of art and music and beauty. Which is fine, Michelle says, because it's true.
The spirits of our two territories, there is a strong tie that has to do with what probably is best of my country, culture.
It's a reminder that so much of what we love about New Orleans, the culture we package to the outside world and profit off of, a lot of that we got from Haiti. So what can New Orleans do in return? Michelle says, stop looking backwards 200 years when you think of Haiti and make some new memories.
Maybe that will be great, that a new generation creates a momentum for, I wouldn't say reconciliation, but creating a connection back. That's a good utopia.
We're going to get it started right quick. The speaker's going to come up here, give them their full attention.
When I got back to New Orleans, I took a walk in my own neighborhood in Mid-City. It was a Sunday afternoon, and I saw a group of people standing around this now empty pedestal where a statue of Jefferson Davis once stood. The city removed this and three other Confederate monuments in the spring of 2017. People took turns passing around a crappy PA system and climbing up onto the empty pedestal to share their visions of replacement statues. This is where I met Nick Aziz.
I think moving forward, we need to have monuments that represent the true identity of the city. For me, I think that identity is Haiti.
Nick is 26. His mom was born in Haiti, and he's a first-generation New Orleanian.
For many people do not realize all the contributions that Haiti has to the city. So I think
I honestly hadn't been expecting to hear anyone talk about Haiti at this thing. So I went to Nick's house the next day to ask him why.
You know, I think a lot of the issues that we see, whether it's violence or economic opportunity or whatever, some of that is rooted in identity issues. And I think, like, if you show people who they are and, like, what they come from, that can have an impact on where they go.
We've heard about folks not visiting Haiti, but Nick is one New Orleanian that did back in 2011. He was 20.
As soon as I got there, I felt something. Like, I just, one of the most unique feelings of my life.
But it became more than that. Nick met family members he had previously only known on Facebook. He played soccer and talked about Kobe Bryant with kids in the neighborhood he was staying in. He got made fun of for not speaking Creole. And that's when Nick was like, yeah, you're right. I want to know Creole.
I had this very deep desire to, like, find that side of myself more. Because, like, I don't speak Creole, but, like, I have a Haitian mother and my grandfather's from Haiti, but, like, still at the same time, like, I don't feel enough of that side of me.
In a lot of ways, Nick embodies the utopia that the former prime minister of Haiti, Michel Pierre-Louis, talked about. The young generation returning to Haiti to dig further into their roots and reignite an exchange. When Nick goes to Haiti and talks to Haitians about New Orleans, they learn how they're tied to the States. That forms them the way it forms him, Nick says. It's about shaping his home, both of his homes.
There should definitely be, like, so much more, like, cultural connecting going between the two cities. Just creating that channel to share that knowledge will allow both places really seeing, like, the sides of its identity that, you know, it really doesn't see and know yet.
That's why he sees the New Orleans Tricentennial as a perfect opportunity to move beyond these warm and fuzzy feelings the city has for Haiti and formally acknowledge it as a key part of the city's identity, past and present. And he's got an idea for a new monument to replace the white Confederate statues. Nick envisions a sculpture that celebrates one of the most iconic and meaningful traditions that Haiti gave to New Orleans. The second line.
That, you know, commemorates the idea that this tradition came from Haiti. You know, it was called Ra-Ra, and it came from Haiti. And
second lining has roots in West Africa, but in Haiti, it became a celebration called Ra-Ra. It came to New Orleans from Haiti during that migration following the revolution.
Because everybody in New Orleans knows a second line. Everybody loves second lining. Everybody loves that part of our culture. But then have, like, a little, like, historical blur by it that shows, like, oh, wow, like, I didn't know this came from Haiti. Wow.
You are listening to the Tripod special, Haiti and New Orleans is the Feeling Mutual. It's almost over. Don't go away. Epilogue. Same, same, but different.
Okay.
I'm with a banjo player named Pierre Renel Antoine. He goes by Renel. We're in a city in the north called Cap Haitien, and we sit in a little coffee shop around the corner from his apartment. We talk about his life as a musician, we talk about jazz, why he chose the banjo. I ask Renel to play me one of his favorite songs, and he doesn't hesitate. It's a children's song called Panama Ntombe. It's based on the Haitian proverb that says, when one's hat falls, trouble is coming.
So that song actually reminded me a little bit of this song, but I know there's a song I want to play you. Hold on. It's called Aiko.
Aiko Aiko is a classic New Orleans tune about two Mardi Gras Indian tribes that have a confrontation in the street. We pull up the version by the Dixie Cups to play for Renel. It sounds like Haitian music, Renel says, and he starts humming along. My fixer Andre is with us, and he starts translating for Renel.
I thought it was a traditional Haitian song when I heard it. The rhythm is almost the same, so almost the same music.
It's almost the same, he says. Not exactly, but almost. Tripod is a production of WWNO New Orleans Public Radio in collaboration with the Historic New Orleans Collection and the Midlow Center for New Orleans Studies at UNO. This Tripod special was made possible with support from the New Orleans Center for the Gulf South at Tulane University through the Global South Fellowship Program, and to WWNO General Manager Paul Mawson, who agreed to this whole thing. As always, thanks to Evan Christopher for our opening theme music, and a special thanks to Bruce Sunpie Barnes for providing us with some of his original music that you heard in the program. Eve Abrams is the editor of Tripod, along with senior advisors Molly Mitchell and Jess Dorman, and our trusty Tripod editorial board, Kevin Harrell, Connie Atkinson, Lee Loomis, Karen Leatham, Charles Chamberlain, Christina Bryant, and Christopher Harder. Special thanks to my field producer, Wynn Muscatine Graham, our fixer, Andre Polt, our sound engineers, Thomas Walsh and Peter Klingelhofer, and Tripod interns, Ann Hackett, Tori Bush, and Michael Sarasso. There are so many other people who made this special possible, so thank you to Alexis Urquhart and Ben Depp, Nicole Phillips, Jacques Bartoli, Maurice Dejon, Mehdi Chalmers, Ned Sublett, Electra Karras, Zach Niles, Rolando Boonster, Gregory Meves, the ASB Hospital in Bourne, Haiti, the George family in Cap Haitien, Vicky Merrick, Maggie Herman, Sangha Tab, and Marina Maguire. This is the official kickoff for season 3 of Tripod, which means it's more important than ever to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts and write us a review. We are finally approaching the tricentennial and need your help to get the word out about our show. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at TripodNola, and hit us up on there. We want to know what you think of this story and the stories you want to hear in the upcoming season. Thanks, everybody. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levinson, and I'll Tripod you later.